Today on the Rights and Wrongs podcast, I'll be joined by Alan Yeek, the founder of the political organization Alt-Raged, where we will talk about issues such as corruption in the political system, lobbyists, and the student debt crisis. Due to the fact this was recorded around the holidays, there's going to be a little bit more ambient noise than you're probably used to for hearing a podcast. But as you'll hear us discuss, in the realm of politics, we have to adapt to reality and reality can't adapt to us. But other than that, I hope you enjoy this week's episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast. Welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast, the podcast where we talk about rights, privileges, and misconceptions. I'm your host, George Oakes. Today, I'm joined by Alan Yeek. We're going to talk on bipartisan / nonpartisan politics today and corruption. I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Alan, and thank you for being on.
George, thank you for the opportunity. Alt-Raged, which you can find at altraged.com, is an organization that I started this July in Asheville, North Carolina. And it is with the belief that the alternative position today is neither left or on the right, but somewhere down the center. And it is a position that is overlooked by mainstream media. So we will often hear all the issues going on against each other, but not where we can come together. And as an example I always give is immigration, where one side was reported, you know, build the wall the entire distance, the other side, no, completely open borders. And the reality is there's a thousand things that can be done in between that. But because there's so much hatred on both sides, we never get there. So Alt-Raged is people before party. And our focus is on corruption in politics, corruption and mismanagement in higher education, and corruption and mismanagement in our healthcare system.
Yeah, and also, you're not new to politics anyway. You're a fellow, former, I know there's no such thing as ex-Marine, so you're a jarhead just like I was.
Number five, brother.
And also, you were in education, and not just in any education. You actually worked in administration of my sister's old, I always forget the term, old Larde, or at Elmira College.
Elmira College, yeah. Between the Marine Corps and the U.S. Foreign Service Diplomatic Corps, I have, the Marine Corps, I was Special Intelligence Telecommunications, 2651. In the Department of State, I was an Information Management Officer, which is, again, you're encrypting, decrypting. You're working through the classified communications between Maine State and the other embassies throughout the world. So I have 10 years in the intelligence field, federal government intelligence field, and then another 23 years in higher education. And that's at two-year institutions, community colleges, four-year institutions up through graduate, and then also international education, where I was 7 years in the United Arab Emirates for their one of their state-run higher education institutions that went across, it was actually 17 campuses.
Yeah, and it's just important for like my listeners to know, it just, you're not, when you started this organization, you're not just, and this isn't against anyone that does this, but you're not some person that's just like, I'm going to start my own political group with like no experience of what's going on. You've been in the education side, you've seen the intelligence side, you've worked within government, you've worked out of government, worked with the military. And I just wanted to make sure my listeners knew that it wasn't just...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, sometimes because when we're self-evaluating, we can discontinue some things, but that's our own type stuff. Whereas the reality is. I do consider myself an expert in higher education administration. And how lost higher education is in the United States.
Which is a huge issue right now going on. One of the missions of the Rights and Wrongs podcast in the beginning, the wrongs part of it, is misconceptions. And a huge misconception issue is buzzwords. And I always like to ask every one of my guests in their fields if there's any buzzword or two buzzwords that they feel is overused, completely thrown out of context, or something we would even realize they're misusing. Do you have any word or term for that?
Well, absolutely. There's two that come to mind immediately. One on the political side, one on higher education. On the political side, over the last year or two, it's been when out of Washington, when they talk about the vision of the founding fathers. No one in 1776 could envision, you know, the past several years and what's going on, or the past century. It just wasn't something within their ability. And this is a group, you know, God bless them. We're here. I'm here because of them, because they stood up to tyranny and established the United States of America. But the United States of America in 1776, which was established by white male landowners, we the people, is not the country of today. And democracy that we think we have is more of a the outside of the shell. It's a thin layer. And if you peel it back, we're getting more and more away from true democracy. So when I would hear these politicians stand up and talk about the vision of the founding fathers, which are you so out of touch? And the answer is yes, with those who you serve in this country, that you're citing somebody that in their wildest imagination could not imagine the issues that we face today. You know, back then it was, it was the British, it was taxes. Maybe someone would steal a horse. We had some corn. We were going to persecute the local indigenous population. You know, it was a different time. That was the extent of it. Whereas today we've got everything from employment to education to healthcare, you name it. And it's on a global level too. Whereas back then it's much limited. So founding fathers, when I hear that, if I had hair on the back of my neck, it would stand up.
I definitely agree on that when it comes to founding fathers. One argument I always find very interesting, and this isn't in, like, people always take this as a attack on religion. This isn't an attack on religion, but one thing I always hear people say, it's like, well, America was founded on Judeo-Christian values. We're a Christian nation because of, like, the Declaration of Independence. And I always, like, try and point them towards the Treaty of Tripoli. And, like, the Treaty of Tripoli, if you go, I think it's Article 10 or 11, says this was never founded and is not a Christian nation, therefore we have no issue with Muslim men. And the first thing people will always use the argument, that's not what the founding fathers meant by it. It was signed in 1797 under John Adams. Four of the founding fathers wrote and signed that. So it's very interesting how when we, like, people like to pick and choose what the founding fathers want. I think this is like a random historical note, but I always find it fascinating to listen to John Quincy Adams defend the freed slaves off the ship. And they're trying, the prosecution is trying to quote the founding fathers. And then John Quincy Adams just leans on the bust of his father in the Supreme Court. And he's like, actually, Uncle Tom meant this when he wrote, like, but it's interesting how we try to fight. But that's an argument that started with the children of the founding fathers. And we still like to argue it today.
Sure.
Which I find is just fascinating.
And exactly like you said, pick and choose. So, you know, which is manipulation, and it's done across the board by, you know, whether you're talking, if someone's citing the Bible, someone's citing the Quran, someone's citing the Constitution, someone's citing, they pick and choose. And by taking it out of context, they can twist it, manipulate. And if you're not knowledgeable to how to dig in and find out the information for yourself, you're probably believe what they're saying. You know, you have this trust, and the reality is it's not there. So that's on the political side. On the educational side, the buzzword that is long dead is student-centered. And the only thing that is student-centered in higher education today is, when will they pay their bill? When will they pay their tuition? When can we get the money from them? That's where it's centered. Everything else, it's become a poorly run business. Whereas there was a time when, and this is how it should be, every decision made on campus, the first question that has to be asked is, will it hurt or help the students? Now, if it's neither, that's fine. You proceed. But if it's hurt, you don't do it. And everything you do on campus, whether you're the person who mows the grass, sweeps the halls and empties the trash. You're the person that, or you're the chair of the business department. Everything you do should be towards helping those students. That's not what we have today. We have some well-meaning faculty that can do what they can in the classroom. But overall, as a business, as an industry, higher education it has lost their focus on students. And it's become about the money first and foremost.
That brings a very big question, because I think we're over like what, $1.3 or $1.6 trillion in student debt in the United States.
1.7.
Oh, so it keeps growing. And it's just insane to think about that. But it's not unheard of for American students to be $250,000 in student debt. For just master's or PhDs, you're looking at $350,000 to $400,000 in student debt, which... And like people are going like, oh, like, well, that if you're doing that, you're probably becoming a doctor or a lawyer. Well, not all doctors make the big bucks. Not all lawyers. Like, you want to be a, and like, it's interesting too, because I feel like the debt crisis also alters students' views. Because like, I was thinking about being a lawyer, and I was looking at becoming a defense worker for like working for the city and the state. But they don't make any money, but I'd still be working. So I'd still have to work off all that debt that I'd be paying the same amount of debt as the private lawyers are making, and then people wonder why there's not enough defense lawyers. Well, there's no money in defense for public defense, I should say. There's plenty of money if you're trying to defend certain politicians and corporations, but when you're defending the little guy that can't afford it, there is no money in it, and I feel like that causes a lot of issues. But how do you think going forward we can stop this? Is it, do we have to start regulating the banks? Do we have to have a stronger regulation on the schools?
I'll go to the student loan issue specifically right now, and then we'll branch out to a little bit more of education. But the student loan issue, if you're not involved in it, I mean, people that are not involved in it, they just see the press headlines and they don't understand the depth of it. This started over 50 years ago. Now in the early 60s, Johnson started his war on poverty, and part of his war on poverty was getting the urban centers able to go to college, which they weren't before. It was too expensive, even though it was very low cost, free to low cost. So then, as we get into the 70s, they open it up more to middle class students too. And now, at the same time, Congress passes a restriction on bankruptcy for student loans. So what they've done at that time is they've criminalized student loans, because the only where you have to be 5 years at that time, 5 years out of college before you can declare bankruptcy on your student loan. The reason they did this initially was because they felt lawyers and doctors, and most of them were lawyers, so it's the irony of it is hysterical to me. Would graduate and then just immediately declare bankruptcy. At that time, there was less than 1% default rate for student loans. Now, we continue on through the Higher Education Act. We get into the 80s and 90s. Money is available to anyone who wants it to go to school. At the same time, you've got the for-profits that have made a huge push into the market. So now you've got this competition going on. You've got which normally you would think is a good thing, but you lose quality control also at that point. And the money went from the federal government or the collection of it to they started first Sallie Mae, which was a pseudo governmental organization, now their own company, which led on to Navient and Nelnet and these other debt collectors. In 2005, they changed again the bankruptcy. Prior to that, it had been somewhere in the 90s, it had changed to a 7-year period. And then in 2005, they eliminated it altogether. So the only way Congress said that you could declare bankruptcy on a student loan was by proving undue hardship. But they never defined it. They intentionally did not define it, which meant it went to individual courts to define. So you've got judges that it's 500% below poverty level. And then you can include that in your bankruptcy. But what has happened also, once you remove that option, even though it wasn't being used, you insured the debt collectors who can now come after your Social Security, can garnish your wages, can take your tax returns, all under the blessing of the United States government. And so as this grew, the schools, who the tuition has gone up in one generation on the average of 400% without justification, 400% above inflation, without true justification of why it's so expensive, other than mismanagement. Higher education is this black hole of money. It'll take everything you throw at it, and it'll still hunger for more. And there's been no accountability for that money other than at the local level. But then, you know, you have the system, the local system policing itself, that you have bodies of accreditation that look at the academic side of it, but not the fiscal side. Sometimes you'll encounter that at state level, Department of Education. But again, the whole system is broken, it's corrupt, and it has now moved for the last several years into its main purpose is survival of itself. So that's as far away as we can get from helping students, which in turn, from a national level, from a country level, we're building our future. So to put the bite on these students for $1.7 trillion, and George, it's the interest rates that get into it. So you have somebody that has $35,000 in student loans. Life comes up, they default. Now that interest rate really kicks up, and then it's put back onto the balance. And then you have that interest rate on a new amount. And I know people that have paid, I was talking to somebody recently. She had a $35,000 loan. She was in the public loan forgiveness program as a teacher. She thought she was. She paid $87,000 total. She thought it was over. They told her she was never in it. They didn't recognize it, and that she owed another $75,000 on a $35,000 loan. And that story is repeated millions of times.
But also, there's another whole entire side of this too, where, and it's not an attack on the older generation, but it is very strange how within two generations, college education, like this wasn't the story for probably when you were going to college or my parents going to college. This wasn't the game, and education completely switched over the last 30 to 40 years, where now you're dealing with an issue where people also don't think about how the business sector affects into this, where we're talking about college and our business, but some people might hear our young millennials complaining about like our bosses and like how we can't leave our jobs, and people are like, oh, just quit your job, like they should be able to treat you better, where they don't realize some of us might have signed, and I know people are in situations like this where they're being underpaid, mistreated by their jobs, but like within the legal thing, but they can't legally leave because they signed an agreement with that business that they paid for X amount of their job, not even probably full, but we're talking maybe 30 or 40% of their education. And if they leave before the contract is up, then they owe all this money back to that business. Mm-hmm. And so now you're in this weird situation where like you might be getting underpaid $15,000 for the job you're doing, but it's easier to not get paid that money than leave the company and then have that $60,000 dropped on you, even though the company is making so much more money off their investment on you than it is to begin with. And there's this, and it's a repeating cycle where now, because of this debt crisis, you're actually giving more power to businesses. And that's why you see a lot of agreements between banks and business and corporations and buying off debt. And it's just something that we don't really talk about, but it's in the looming, once you get out of college, how the debt can affect the rest of your career.
I'm at the tail end of baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And at that tail end, I mean, prior to that, yeah, most of the state schools were free. And then they started charging but it was still the time. So this in the early 80s, you could work a summer job and pay for your college for that year. So you would graduate and you know, you wouldn't know anything. So that's how many of the boomers look at it. And that's when I have to respond to them, okay, boomer, and then follow up with the, hey, get off my lawn. Because they closed down. They're not listening to what's being said. They're going by a memory they had of their dear old alma mater. And it's just these kids that can't balance the budget and they waste their money and they're just frivolous. And I can't tell you how many people over 50 years old are in debt over $100,000 in student loans. So it's not that situation. It's a criminal activity. It's racketeering at the government level. It's, you know, I always say that it's government loan sharking enforced with judicial muscle, and the mafia wishes they ever had it so good.
It's so true what you're talking about when it comes to the older generation, which my dad often jokes, but it's not really a joke because he's 68, I believe, right now. So he's mid baby boomer generation, born in the early 50s. But he often says that it's scary that he's younger than most politicians sitting in Senate right now. And like, so the people that, the problems that he was having in education, the generation that's ahead, that's still controlling the country, they're basically might as well be in ye olden times when it comes to these issues. And that's the funny thing is one of the oldest politicians, Bernie Sanders, is one of the few that actually understands what's going on with a lot of this. But when you're talking about the older generation not listening, it always reminds me of this Wall Street Journal article that I read that I can't stop laughing about when they're blaming our generation for motorcycle sales going down. But they're focusing only on Harley Davidson because the truth is Harley Davidson, you can buy a brand new Ferrari for the cost of a brand new Harley. It's an expensive motorcycle. And they're like, well, new generation, like they don't know what they want. Like we made exactly what they want. We made a $100,000 electric motorcycle and they're not buying it. It's their fault the motorcycle industry is going down. Where if you talk to like Honda and like Suzuki, like they're doing fine as motorcycle industry because they're making cheap, affordable, easy to maintain bikes. And that's what we want. Like we're not looking, I can't drop $200,000 on a motorcycle. I can't even afford to buy a house because of how the student loan crisis is. And I think that's like a prime example of like these big businesses and financial institutions not listening to the newer generations coming in, but we're not doing what they want to do. So therefore it's our fault.
The politicians are aware of all of this. Mm-hmm. And here's what's going on with them. And here's why they allow it. Here's why they keep the bankruptcy for student loans criminalized. And here's why they don't, the solutions that you're hearing coming out. Oh, we're going to give $50,000 to every student loan. We're going to give 30, we're going to give 20, you know, whatever it is, it's coming out of their mouths. Only ensures that the problems continue. And here's why. Navient, Nelnet, these companies that are making billions off of student loan debt are also contributing through super PACs to the campaigns of our elected politicians. Even. So it's not like, you know, this is, they're buying Republicans, they're buying Democrats, they buy them all. So there's no incentive for our elected officials looking out for us to change the system. Because, this is coming in through super PACs. So let me shift a little bit on the political side, which also ties in to the education. So a PAC is a political action committee. Back in 2010, it was brought to the Supreme Court in 2009. They ruled on it in 2010. And in fact, it'll be 10 years this January that they ruled. And what this case is, it's Citizens United versus the Federal Election Committee. And this was on campaign reform. So the Supreme Court overturned a case in Michigan, which by doing so has allowed corporations and the wealthiest individuals to donate unlimited money to political campaigns and through super PACs which then do not have to report where the money came from. It's so dirty. And this is why when I go back to the political side, you may, you know, some the country may feel, oh, we voted for this person. And we did. They're in office because we cast our vote for this person. That's where it ends. Because then they've got their corporate masters that they have to answer to and follow the money. And that's what's going on right now through these super PACs. And it also affects higher education and why the student loan issue remains where it is today.
Well, you also hit a very interesting point, though, too, because the fact that Americans are very unaware of things. I always watch memes and I like read articles, which a lot of people are posting. And one that I understand where it's coming from, but it's also the value of a dollar changes from place to place very greatly in the United States. And I always find it interesting where the people that are very against like the $15 minimum wage or people from Virginia or Wisconsin or something, where $15 is a lot of money there. I understand that. Mm-hmm. In Boston, that doesn't like cover my coffee for the week. And like that's talking like cheap coffee, like not even fancy. Like that's like Dunkin' Donuts. $15 won't cover my coffee. And that's not even including tip, which those people need to live off of. So money changes an experience. And this one meme I keep saying, like seeing a meme or like this thing people saying, it's like, oh, these politicians make hundreds of thousands of dollars to make no decision. And like they only gave you in that time that they gave you $1,200 in the stimulus check, they made $100,000. I'm like, that's true. So people are now trying to vote to lower the amount that senators and congressmen make, which in truth is actually working in the lobbyists' favor. Because when you have lobbyists like AOC and a lot of like the younger politicians that refuse to take lobbyist money, $100,000 to maintain an apartment in New York City and DC. You can't do that in those two cities. Like, you need that full salary to maybe get a studio in one of those, never mind both. So it's kind of strange how people are trying to push against taking away that salary from those congressmen, where it's like you're hurting the congressmen that are most likely to help you, and you're pushing everyone else more into the lobbyists' hands, where we should be making limiting lobbying funds, having like government kind of an oversight. I'm going to try to go over this to make sure that money isn't going from their campaign into their own pocket, because that happens quite a bit. And it's just interesting when you're looking at politics, how we try to simplify a lot of things, but these things are so complex and purposely beautifully complex that they want us to have knee-jerk reactions like that, where it's like when I see people post that, it's like, whoa, that's, I understand where you're coming from, like point A to point B logic, that makes sense. But actual government logic is like you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Well, that's it, point A to point B logic. But for all of this, multiple things have to happen simultaneously. And then it has to also be followed up on. And you have to build a system for correction and monitoring and all of that. With the political side and the student loans, they're too profitable right now to, so that's why when they give out this $50,000 that they're talking about, that's nothing, because you haven't addressed the cost of education. You haven't addressed the bankruptcy issue. So all you've done is kick the can down the road, but you appear as if you're helping people. Today it was just announced, or last night, Congress came to agreement for the next COVID relief package coming out. And everybody that makes under $75,000 will get $600. And then there's a bump on unemployment and some other things. Where they come up with these numbers, it's never explained. But what jumps out at me is I would rather have a plan for rebuilding the country, for how we come out of this situation, than just the money. The money can be there. People will, you know, pass something that for the time being, there's no evictions, a moratorium, continue the student loan moratorium, which they haven't. It'll go to the end of January right now. There's things that can be put in place with the money, but they don't. Just their poor leadership.
Well, I think it's also a really good point that you talk about these arbitrary numbers, because especially with the $1,200 of the first stimulus check, I don't think it's like they're pulling these numbers up, but I think there's actually like there is logic behind it on their side. Because $1,200 to you and I from being where we live and work, it's not a lot of money. $1,200 for a Bostonian or a New Yorker, that's not even going to cover rent. That's not going to cover your rent for a studio. That's
no, no, what?
But they already know that those are Democratic voters. They're not trying to appease them. They're trying to appease the Republican voters who might come from a place where $1,200 is a lot of money that can cover 2 months' rent or something like that. So then they see the North, like, then they're just going to see, oh, look at the Democrats. They're crying for more money. They just don't want to work. Like, they don't want to live. Like, $1,200 is fine. Where we are, like, and that's where I go, where people don't realize the value of dollar changes quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that makes an argument is I was talking to someone and they're like, oh, like, you expect the government to track down and know the cost of living for every single area, city, and town, and disperse and find that information. Well, they already do. That's how they did my that's how they did my VA benefits. Yes. I made a very specific amount of money going to college in Boston, where I made a lot. I made close to $3,000 a month. But if you're down in Tampa Bay, Florida, you make somewhere around, I think, $1,400 a month, because they know the cost of living is different. So they're not going to pay, because like, they know, like, I'm not going to be splurging this money on myself. Most of that's going to rent. So I found it very interesting how they decided not to do that with the stimulus package. And I think it was a very specific political move.
Well, it had to be, because, you know, my first thought is they're lazy, but lazy doesn't make them money.
Yeah.
So no, there's something to how this was laid out. We'll never know, but it wasn't to the benefit of the people.
No.
It wasn't, you know, they have the rhetoric that always comes out about helping the people. It's not about us. And I don't know if it's ever been about us. And maybe if there's one good thing that's come out of COVID, it's been that the people have had more focus on our government and how it operates, and the corporations that control it.
And just for any of my European listeners, like when we're talking about this, and we're talking mainly about the student debt crisis, we're talking about private loans for the most part, because many people here in the like UK and Europe, like they only have federal student loans. Like they can't go to their local bank and get a student loan the way that we can. So I've been fortunate that all of my debt is federal loans, but that's because I'm a postgraduate student. So I'm a less at risk. Everyone in the U.S. has access to federal loans, but only $20,000 a year. But that doesn't cover maybe even a fraction of what is going to cost them that year. So they have to go to Sallie Mae or their private banks. And this is where it's gotten a little unregulated. And this is where the money goes up. And then because they've opened up the banks, the schools are realizing, oh, we can charge a little like $10,000 more this year and make more. And that's what we're talking about. Because opening up the banks and open up the federal loans to go to education is a good thing. Having everyone have the ability to go to college and being able to access school is a great thing. It's just gotten unregulated. And that's what we're talking about. Just I want to make sure anyone that's not from America understands what we're speaking on.
Yes. And it's beyond needing regulation, because there's a lot of regulations out there, but the enforcement of it, becomes another issue. As our higher ed system, our educational system, so K-12 up, is built upon, it's an agrarian system where Johnny and Jebediah had to go out and bring in the crops. And so around that, we did school. And then it became also, it wasn't until the early part of the 19th century that there was such a thing as public school. Before that, if you went to, you know, up to eighth grade, somebody was paying for that. So it wasn't until a little past the turn of the century that we recognized the value of education that every contributes to society, to a country, to the world. So here we are, the wealthiest country in the world, although it's just slipping through as we shift from country to individuals on that. We see Germany does it. We see Australia does it. We see a lot of the countries in the world pay for their population, for the citizens' education through a doctorate level, because it builds the country. Whereas we're stuck in this, again, baby boomer. Well, I had to pay. Well, I had to pay for my kids. Am I getting my money back? Hey, bud, I'm sorry. Things have shifted. It's more important that we build a country, and when I say education, I don't just mean degrees. I mean, if someone wants to be a carpenter, an electrician, the trades are desperate for people. We should embrace those because the country needs it. So we've got to help those people too. There's more than enough cash out there. We bailed out Wall Street for a lot of money, trillions of dollars. We bailed out the billionaires, but our own citizens, we turn our back on.
Well, no, it's also interesting you talk about the trades issue because there's a few different interesting parts about that. First off is it can happen. I went to a very unique school called Quincy High in Quincy, Massachusetts, where I graduated with two high school diplomas, both a vocational and a trade. And I was taking physics. I was taking honors English. I was in my maths and history classes every single day. So you're like, oh, you didn't go to a trade school. But as soon as lunch was over, I was in the welding shop building gates for the school. The kids in the automotive were fixing the cars for the mayor and like the limousines.
Great program.
Yeah, and like they're doing stuff like that. When I left, I was a certified welder. My friends left as certified plumbers. They left as certified electricians. Like they have, like I have something to fall back on. Like my certifications are all expired long by now, but I have a skill that I can always fall back on. But it also gave me an option for people, like I said, coming back to anyone that's not an American listener. Not necessarily you can't go to college without a high school diploma. Like if you have a GED and stuff, but they might not accept a vocational school diploma. So the fact that I have two, walking out, because at 18 years old, expecting you to know what you want to do for the rest of your life, I'm about to be 29 at the end of this month, and I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. Like, it's just, it's a constant learning experience, and expectation on like 16-year-olds is unrealistic, but at least that way I had a feel for what it would be like to get into the actual trades. And then people go like, well, you can always join the military, and like, this is a twofold issue. One, there's an interesting paper, and I need to find it. A friend from here in Europe sent it to me, where it talks about we can't do free college in the U.S. because it would detriment enlistment numbers in the United States because so many people join the military for free college, which is a very strange concept because now you're indoctrinating people and then they get the education and they're on the fast track to become politicians. And that's good and bad. There's a mixture there. But also, I got sold on it because I'm an electrical engineer. It's like, you'll have a trade for the rest of your life when you leave the Marine Corps. I'm not a certified electrical engineer. Do I understand it? Yes, but no one's going to hire me. Like I don't have the certifications or the college diplomas to back me up or insure me. So that's where there's a lot of lying in education and career fields in the United States, right? I don't think we talk about enough.
The whole system of education, K-16, so you know, through your bachelor's degree or master's, or has to be looked at with new eyes. And we have to ask ourselves every part of it. Why? Why this subject? Why at this age? Why at this point do we move them up? Why the hours? Why the times of day? Why the credentials of the teachers? Why everything has to be asked why? And what we've done over the years is there's a film, The Winchester House, and it's based upon the widow of the Winchester rifle magnate, who, you know, it said it was all the ghosts of the people that the weapons had killed haunted her. So she built this mansion and continued to build it and add on to it. But it was a mansion of nothing. It was a mansion where stairs went up and just stopped. They didn't go anywhere. Where doors were open and there was nothing there. But it continued on for like 30 something years. This construction never ended until her death. This is higher education. This is education in America, where we've got a bad foundation. And then the politicians will again put unfunded mandates into education. And the worst with that, the unfunded mandates, K-12 is the worst hit by it, because they're left to figure it out. And what happens in any system like that is it becomes, we got to hit our numbers. So it's not, okay, Janice and Camille aren't learning. What can we do? How do we approach them? What's a new way to teach? Why do they need it? It becomes, look, if we don't get these numbers, then we're going to lose our state funding. So the push is for that instead of learning. And it continues on today. And I don't believe, or I hope the politicians are not that ignorant. I don't know who's advising them, but somehow they're making money off it, because otherwise it would change, and it's hurting the country. And just real quick, going back about the cost of education you mentioned earlier.
I just wanted to add one thing. Sure. When you talked, you kept using the term K-12, and for anyone that's not from America, if you're from the UK or France or somewhere else, K through 12 is a short way of saying our public elementary schools. So K being kindergarten, 12 being up to your senior year of high school, which you probably call like secondary school or finishing school here in the UK. So yes. With K through 12, it's the free public school before university. That's what we're referring to.
Yes, just thank you.
To clarify that.
Thank you, George. So now we have, you know, you talked about the people that let's say you want to be a public defender. Well, also in this country, social workers and teachers, we're dying for them. But you leave with a $40,000 in debt, if you're lucky, that's all, and you get hired on at $28,000 a year because these jobs don't pay that much. But they're critical. The whole system is broken and needs to be, we need to bring the minds together. So this is not where I would sit in a room and go, I think that we should do this. There's a lot of smart people out there that recognize the system is broken, and let's start as if it's 2021 going forward, not 1870. What can we tag on top to appear to be fixing it? We continue to slide in the global rankings for math and science. Yet we've established these STEM programs. We've established these science and math. Now, because it's not happening at the right time by the right people, it's just thrown in there for a parent. I'd like to believe that those people involved work very hard at trying to make it work. But it's like putting a Ford engine on a wagon with wooden wheels and wondering why you're not getting very far. So it's all of education in the U.S. And having worked overseas, I got to work with some brilliant international administrators and faculty. And one of the things that I really enjoyed was within the United States, arts and letters are a big thing, meaning for a four-year degree, you're going to have 2 years of what we think you need for your personal growth. I don't know if that's true or not, because Europe seems to be doing okay when they pick a major and their classes are set on that. So there's a lot of directions we can go, but if we stay where we're at, the decline will only continue.
Well, it's also an interesting point, too, where you're talking about with STEM, and I'm noticing one thing where a lot of times when it comes to, like, the main purpose of when you want to study for personal growth, I think it's always, it should be the first thing about education is personal growth and learning more about the world around you. But one of the main purposes is all you need to get a job to survive. So, like, that's one of the great things about it. But the other issue is we have a disconnect between the business and the corporate world and education. Where this is the sad thing, it's going to work with STEM, is you have a lot of great degrees out there, but they're not aware. And like, I see this a lot where people are like, oh, why is someone getting a liberal arts degree? Like, what are they going to do with that? There's no job for liberal arts. And I'm kind of stuck in that right now with my human rights master's, where it's funny, I'll apply for jobs that have human rights in the title. They see my degree and they don't know. Like, it's interesting how many times I've applied to things for like a human rights job. And they're like, oh, you have a very impressive resume, but we don't think you're qualified for this job. But it's like, I have a master's in human rights, and you need a human rights representative, but because they don't know this degree,
sure.
They don't nail it. Like, so many times I get referred to HR, like, oh, you need, here's an HR rep. And I'm like, I'm not human rights. And unfortunately, the human rights person is the only person in that corporation that knows what my job is, like my degree's in. Like, you're not human resources, and they push me away. But I see that also as a problem where, like, you have that with education where a lot of people want to get these better degrees, but they're ahead of their time, too, which is a frustrating thing to deal with.
There's a huge disconnect between the market, the, you know, what's needed by the businesses and education. education at a university. If I had IBM come to me and say, here's what we need, and we need it now. Education in America will take at least 2 years of committee meetings before that program would be unveiled. And so that example goes across the board and across universities, across community colleges. Community college is not, it's a different mission there. But if you want to put on something new, the committee involvement is ridiculous. There's a point that you need to involve faculty in it every step of the way. It just doesn't have to take the length of time. So every time that happens, and you know, there's the thing that came out years ago that we have no idea what the jobs are going to be in 10 years. We know what some of them are going to be, but there's going to be new jobs too. So that's where it becomes that the education has to have a big focus on teaching how to learn beyond what you've learned in that specific class. Because we're lifelong learners, we don't know what we're going to need to know 10 years from now, but we have to have the ability to learn. And with technology and not, we've seen COVID and the use of technology in education is not improved because it was not used correctly. I mean, it was used in higher ed, it was stuck in there to keep the money rolling in. You've had online classes are great that are developed for online classes that are taught by teachers who know how to teach online classes to students who have taken an orientation how to take an online class. COVID administration said, well, we got to keep the money coming. So teach. So you've got these teachers that have no idea of the pedagogy of online instruction with a class that they have taught in the classroom. And they just stick it over, and they know they're more aware than anyone that teaching and learning isn't going on. So the thing with technology is always, technology and education is always, the tail can never wag the dog, and the dog being education. But it's how we use it and where we're going next with it. And it's going to be, at one point, a true virtual type situation, where it'll seem like I'm in the classroom. I'll raise my hand. I'll have that same interaction. When that'll be, within my lifetime, it's going to be there. But education has to adapt, higher education is the, you know, I always had this before I got into it. I always had this imagination of that, you know, it was this progressive group of people that were ready for change and embracing it and everything. Oh my God. I've seen small manufacturers that were more ready to change than education. So it's outside of the system itself. It's the people within it that you have to bring through change management, why we're doing it, and take them out the other end to have a lasting impact. And you know, as we look in Europe, you know, Finland has always been a tremendous leader in the research of education and how people learn. And so we're not inventing the wheel again. There's so much out there, but we have to be open to wanting to do it and open to recognizing the need.
Well, I think it's also it is important to look at Finland and stuff like that. But the one thing is, I don't think America's ready for a Scandinavian approach to anything at this point. Because I've got a lot of friends that are Finnish. I have a lot of friends that are like Norwegian and stuff. And something I've realized through them is they have a sense of society and community that we're not even close to. It's also strange too that like people don't realize Finland is one of the few nations I would say is more militarized than the United States, because all men serve in the military, but it's expected. But also they have a questionable history with their neighbor Russia but it's their idea, like they're basically erased through the entire time, where Finnish people, like, they're very tolerant to their neighbors, they're private to themselves, but mm-hmm. like it seems like for the most of it they're raised in a very community sense, and not just in town and not just as a state, but like as a nation, they try to do everything their best to survive as a nation. Where when you're from an area that Finland was probably not a most hospitable environment throughout most of their history to things. So this community environment is literally to survive. You can't survive as a single person in that area. And it's, I think it's going to take some trying of Americans to ever get to that level of trust and accepting of help and opening to new ideas that something might not be in their best interest, but the best interest of us all. And I think that's one reason, like, that's a great thing to look at. And I really hope we do, but I can also see the dangers of trying to jump into a system like that. And that's how people take advantage of stuff. And
to push that as is forward, it would be destroyed as is. But what we have to do as a society, as a culture, is really recognize those people that are struggling. To tell you the truth, I don't care if they brought it on. I don't care if they made mistakes. Ultimately, my view is if someone needs help, how do we help them? And I'm not concerned if they get their, I forget what the dollars are called, when you get money from the state to buy groceries. I don't care if they're buying steaks. I don't care. My point is that we have to help them. And because if we don't, what I'll say is in the last generation, what's gotten better? It continues to slide down, and that wealth gap continues to widen. And then the police are used by the wealthy against those struggling. The whole system, it has to take on a different form, and it won't happen overnight, but we have to start and we have to keep building. And I think over the last year with all the protests, was a good start, but it has to move from a protest to a system change. And some things have, but there's still a lot more work to do.
Well, I think that the protest is a good point. I've also was about to go where you're talking about caring about helping the people. And this is the very American versus Scandinavian Nordic view of when it comes to crime. And let's just use crime as an overall thing. When Americans see a criminal, they say they did that to themselves. They failed society. So I don't care when they get out of job, get out of prison, that they don't get a job because they did it to themselves. That's the American way of looking at it. The Nordic way of looking at it is we failed them. They went to crime because they didn't have something. If it was mental health, we didn't give them the proper care. If they needed to steal to survive, we didn't get them the proper care. If they'd gone on to, like, let's say they were using drugs or something else like that, we didn't give them the education or the need. So we failed them. So when they get out, we make sure that when they're in prison, they're well cared for. They get rehabilitation education. We sit down and make sure they get the mental health because we need to figure out what the problem is there. So we don't just lock them up like cattle inside of a pen. And that's what American criminal justice does. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It's that view of when they come out, it's our job as a society to make sure that we take care of them, so in turn they can help the greater society take care of others. Where in America, it's like once you make a mistake, you made that mistake on your own, you're going to live with the consequences. I don't care what you did, just get away from it. And it's a very separate view, and that's what I'm talking about. Like, I don't think Americans are ready for that. And it's not that I'm saying we shouldn't be, because a democracy, you should care about the better man, or else democracy doesn't work. It's just going to be the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie where everyone's voting for themselves and you're getting nothing done. But that's where I get a lot of things. Going back also real quick, I wanted so people understand when you're talking about how we're always behind on what education trends are. Going back with me as a criminal justice student, people think, oh, if you want to be an FBI agent or work for like the U.S. Marshals and stuff, get a CJ degree, you'll be fine. By the time I graduate, there's hundreds of thousands of CJ degrees. But that's not what the FBI is looking for. They're looking for lawyers. They're looking for computer analysts. They're looking for computer techs.
Accountants.
If you want to work for the FBI, apply for those jobs. So if anyone's young listening, trying to figure out what they want to do, or any parents of young children for the future, when you hear your kid wants to go up like, I want to be an FBI agent or whatever, want to be a doctor or want to be anything, get on USA Jobs. Look at the job applications right when your kid's going to college. Look at what those jobs are looking for in degrees, because it might help you be able to influence your children to take a better minor or how to better spend those forced electives onto us. Because electives are both a blessing and a curse, depending on how you use them. Like, I spend them to get extra courses on learning Arabic or sociology, and I got a minor to sociology, which helped me get my master's. So there's ways to avoid it, but if they're wasting it on art or dance, I'm not saying that there isn't worth, but if you're studying business and you're taking ballet, unless you're going into create a ballet business, that's not a good use of that money because you're spending a ton of money for that ballet course. That's not anything on ballet. I just was watching The Nutcracker, which is a beautiful thing for society. But this is stuff you have to think about. And these are conversations we don't have. These are conversations that I didn't have. And the truth is, we were just talking about education change. These electives weren't forced on my parents the way they were forced on me.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. When we were talking about societal changes, we have a complete system. You're talking about someone getting out of jail, that there weren't federal prisons until after the Civil War. There weren't, and you see a lot of the issues that we have. When you send somebody to prison because they were selling pot, or, you know, I'm not talking murderers, rapists, it's just, let's say, a drug-related crime, just possession. What goes on then for them in their lives is they'll leave prison with a whole new skill set of bad things. So we just keep repeating it. And then you've got the revolving door of prison. And prisons are corporations, and prisons make money. And so they need prisoners. So we have our educational system, our political system, our judicial system needs reform too, desperate reform. Right now I'm reading a book called Cast by Isabel Waverly. And it gets into that the U.S. doesn't have a race problem, it has a caste problem. And that the African Americans were at the lower end of the caste, using the example of from India, the Untouchables. It's a great book. I recommend it to anybody out there, Cast.
I'll definitely add it to our books and media recommendation page on the website. But going back on the last point I was going to make is, for anyone that's not a criminal justice major, when you speak about the repeating doors, recidivism, and recidivism is the amount of people or percentage of people that return to prison after being released within a 5-year period. And the recidivism rate in the United States is atrocious. We're just between high 70s, low 80s for a national average. My home state of Massachusetts likes to pat itself on the back having the lowest, but it's like 52%. So if you actually think of the number, that means one out of every two prisoners that leave are going to be within 5 years will be back. Not counting later, because the chances of once you open up like the 10 years back, like those numbers jump to the higher to the 90s. Mm-hmm. When you compare it to other nations, it's atrocious. It's literally sickening when you see how we're supposed to be like a leader and like what our rates are. But getting back on that, I did want to focus on your group, which you're the founder of, Alt-Raged, which is, I'm not really sure how to, I've gone through it. I'm not really sure if it's a nonpartisan or a bipartisan group, because you'll try to say like the moderate, which is interesting because moderate changes depending on where you're standing on location. Because I consider myself a moderate, but if I go in UK politics, I'm probably more conservative. Mm-hmm. But in Massachusetts, I'm seeing conservative down south. They seem as a bleeding heart liberal. So moderate's a very relative term. But you talk about you're looking at focusing on people, not parties when it comes to politics. I'm just curious, in a time that we seem to be more divided than ever, how do you plan or expect to try and get this? Are you just trying to band together the ignored majority of people that are like, I don't think both sides are stupid, I don't agree with the other, but I'm just trying to vote for those lesser demons? Are you trying to bridge gaps between the more powerful polarized groups?
No, this is Alt-Rage is nonpartisan, so it's not about party. And to your point about, you know, to try to make the left see the right and the right see the left, it's not going to happen if you approach it that way. I mean, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Alt-Rage's approach is, whether you're red, blue, Democrat, Republican, conservative, progressive, whether you're communist, socialism, social democrat, anarchist, you know, whatever you want to call yourself, whatever party that you identify with, whatever beliefs that you identify with, that's fine. Identify with them. But know this. You're being sold out to corporations. That's the point, and that's where we can all come together. So, yeah, there may, you know, and as far as who benefits from that, both everyone that's in that small group on the take will benefit from it. But that's the very smallest. So what I say, it doesn't matter your political party. Understand that whoever is in that office in D.C., in the state capitol, money is coming into them from corporations to do what the corporations want them to do. As an example, when we look at our current healthcare system, or I should say the healthcare system that was developed in 2011, 2012, the Affordable Care Act and all of that, there were 11,000 lobbyists, healthcare lobbyists alone in DC during that time. They wrote the insurance companies, they wrote this, they gave it to the politicians to sign off on. And that is an example. Today, the systems that we operate in, lobbyists, no, they should. If you're a company, if you're a cause, and you want to bring something to Congress, I want to see it too. And the technology is there, so there's no more one-on-one meetings. Put it into a presentation like this and let everyone in America see it and stop that money coming into them. Make them go back to representing the people, regardless of what party you are. Nobody is being represented. Corporations are.
Well, that's what I was just curious about, because there is a lot of issues with the U.S. system. Like, I'm one of the believers that we should extend out how long the House, people in the House are representatives. I think their term should be longer, because it feels like they get an office, they do 9 months of work, and they're back on the campaign trail again. They spend half their life on the campaign trail, and it's like those in the House kind of gets overlooked, but like they're the ones that write the bills. Like they're the, like they have a really important job, yet you're never letting them do stuff. Like, so I think they should have an extension. I do think we also need to put term limits on these, so they are more aware of who they are. Like maybe for them, if you extend it to four, have an 8-year term limit for House of Reps. If you do 2 4-year terms, keep the senators at 6, do 2 for 12. And then just do that. I think that would be a way to stop a lot of this, because keep them in their office. But two, going back to our point we were talking earlier, we should really watch over lobbyist groups. And like when people want to cut their payment, they're like, oh, they don't need to make this because they get all that lobbyist money. Well, maybe we should just stop the lobbyist money and make sure we pay them enough money that to survive on.
Well, absolutely. It's recognition of what it takes to survive. But when the tax dollars are being used for parties, I want to say that's on the average like $300,000-$400,000 of these erroneous costs that each politician has to, you know, that'll spend through the year. Now, yeah, if you're in D.C. or you're in one of the state capitals, cost of living is going to be expensive. So that has to be covered. So, but you can create a different system than the lobbyists, than the corporation, than the money, than the super PACs, the dark money that's never known where it comes from. You can create a different system, a better democracy, a true democracy, which we don't have right now.
And it's so true. Also, one second, as we're talking, I wanted to also say, anyone that's listening, if you wanted to ask a question that's going on, because we're coming up close to the time, so we'll probably be on for another 10 minutes. If anyone wants to ask a question that's on the live, if you're listening from a pre-recording, if you ever do want to ask a live question during this, come in, join the lives on Twitch. It's always scheduled up on Twitter, on Twitch, and on the website. But I just want to give the opportunity as we're going. So are there any, do you have any plans, or have you really tried to prosper any petitions or any bills to like local politicians through Outrage? I'm curious. Sorry, I know I didn't ask this before.
No, because it'll have to come from the people up. So I'm looking at building the organization on a national level. And it's as simple as this. If, you know, so-and-so is running for office. The question asked is, will you support the removal of corporate money from your campaign? Yes or no? Will you support the removal of lobbyists or the restructuring of the system? Yes or no? If they answer no, why is that? Where's that no coming from? Because it only benefits them. That doesn't benefit the people. So it is at this point, it's awareness of outraged omission and awareness of what's going on in the country. That case I cited before, Citizens United, which led to the super PACs. Most people hear Citizens United and they think, oh, wow, that sounds like something I want to be part of, something that I'm a citizen and I want to be with each other and help. And no, bad. It's marketing. It's a spin. It's what they're good at. But we, you know, the shingles have to drop from the eyes and we have to see what they're doing and we have to stop it. So grassroots, people up.
I think that's a good point, though, too, is to recognize what a political party or political organization is. I was listening to another podcast, and I believe it was A Spoonful of News, and they made a good mention of this, is when you're supporting a group or supporting a cause, you're part of a movement. If there's an actual organization by that name, make sure it's actually that organization, because like Black Lives Matter gets this whole other thing. The Black Lives Matter organization and the Black Lives Movement as the thing, total different mission goals. The only thing they share is a name and a time and space. Like, that's the only thing they share. And it's very interesting when you talk about that. Like, Citizens United sounds like a great name for an organization. Like, yes, we're going out there. And just, one, don't just read their mission statement, because hopefully their mission statement is true to their cause. But look at their actions. And if they're working within politics, that should be public record. And learn how to go about it, which I think is something that Americans are very bad at, is research. Like, you think, I went on Facebook and I did research. That's not research. That's marketing. Like, I don't know how else to say that.
Sure.
But that's...
No, you're right.
That's the world we need. That's what they also say when people look at that. For, yeah, Citizen United does sound like a great name, but you need to watch the track record. And it sounds like outrage when you're talking about this. The flashback I had in my head was like basically like old school baseball cards, where like you have the politician's face and you flip around and have the stats, like who's paying for them and stuff like that, or how long they've been in office, what's their voting record. And that's a true fact when you look at all that stuff. When you're trying to look that stuff up, it's actually pretty hard to find a politician's background and history. Like, you'd think that it is public record. You should be able to get baseball cards, and essentially, I know I'm using that acronym a lot, but it should be as simple as that, to be able to look at their page and have their voting record and who supports them, what lobbyist groups they work for.
That's another question for them. Would you support, you know, a system that does that? And again, if they say no, gee, why is that? And George, real quick, I need to give a shout out to my Scottish friends in Wishaw, the McGuire clan. And I have to say, Maria McGuire, who was my dean when I was in the UAE, is one of the best leaders, managers of higher education that I've ever known in my life. And so she's back in Scotland working, and whatever institution she's at, they are much better off than they were before she came.
Well, that's, I'm sure she's happy to hear that. Yeah, and you were saying that they're not too far from me here in Glasgow.
No, not at all. Wishaw is just down the road.
It's a lovely place to be here. Did you have any closing ideas?
I just want to let everyone know or remind everybody that you, as the world beats you down, as the governments beat you down, as life can just beat us down, to remember that you do have power. And there's a lot of us out there that we're not heard from, but social media does allow us to come together more so than we ever have. So don't get discouraged, get angry, get a focused angry, not violent, focused angry to power that up, and you can change things for the better. So don't give up. Don't accept status quo.
And I think it's an important thing to also remind me to say is alt-raged is not alt-right. Please don't mix those two up. Those are two very different organizations.
No, absolutely.
I just want to make sure people don't get confused, because like alt are something they look up. I will have you on my guest and appearances page with a background, but anyone listening, did you want to say what websites and like where to follow you, like on Twitter?
Sure. It's on Twitter, it's Altraged. On the website, it's Altraged. Let me spell it, altraged. altraged.com. And on Facebook, just enter in Altraged. The same, A-L-T-R-A-G-E-D. And that name again comes from that the alternative position of today is not on the left or the right, but the center. So that's our approach is finding ways to work together.
It's interesting how alternative itself is becoming a buzzword, because you have alt-right, you have alt-this, alt-left, alternative socialists is another term I've heard, and it's just, it's fun. I get why you're using it, because the truth of it is you're alternative of a different group. But no, I wanted to thank you so much for being on and sharing your views and about the corruption. These are a lot of topics. I feel many Americans and people in the world are aware of it, but it's one of those things that unless you have a decent grasp of it, you'd have no idea what strings to pull on, because you can go down some rabbit holes of conspiracy theories or views. And like you and I both don't know we don't have all the cards in our hands. We don't know what's going on in those backroom deals in DC,
absolutely,
in the universities. We're just making educated guesses the best we can. But there are just, and this is the scary thing, is America's full of conspiracy theories right now, which is, some of them can be very alluring because they sound like they come from a sound place, but because we don't know what's going on. And also the United States politics the last 4 years sounds like something out of a bad political novel.
So you know, to address those conspiracy theorists, I would just say, go for transparency, which is another buzzword, because there's nothing, depending on who's saying the word, the only thing that's transparent is the word itself. There's no transparency in higher ed. There's no transparency in politics. But you can make it that way if that's what you want. And then as far as conspiracies and all that, let's see. Let's ban those closed room meetings between lobbyists and our Congress people. And let's broadcast them out to all of us. And let's implement a system that allows that through our elected officials. So democracy remains, but it's a democracy that works.
Which I think is a very good point. And also one thing, I don't want anyone thinking that we're saying that we don't believe anything in government should be secret. Like, you clearly came from intelligence in the military. I've worked in military and stuff, and I've worked for defense contractors. Make things transparent that should be transparent. Like, I don't want to sit in a CIA meeting, even though they're probably doing some things we won't agree
absolutely
with. But there's no reason why the financial future of our nation is behind closed doors. There's no reason why how they're setting up the future of our environmental is behind closed doors, or how they're going to go forward with education. There are things that need to be non-transparent for legitimate security reasons, but I feel like the government likes to throw that ease of behind closed doors from the things that need to be behind closed doors, then they try to work other stuff that shouldn't be.
Oh, absolutely. And then when they put it into, let's say, a hearing, an open hearing, it becomes a circus, because it's about that senator or congressman getting TV airtime and just, you know, getting their points in against the other person or against the group, or and not. So it becomes more of a show instead of a presentation of facts. The whole system is ripe for change, for the betterment of the country, for the betterment of the world. True democracy.
But it's funny also too, because like, I'm one of those people, and I know a lot of people are thinking like, oh, I'm crazy. I'm one of those Americans that think that the U.S. Constitution needs an overhaul. But at the same point, I don't trust a single politician in office right now to be one of those doing it. Like, I'm in that weird situation. Like, it needs to be redone, but I don't trust anyone to do it. So I'm in that damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
Well, if a politician were to do it, they're doing what their corporate masters told them to do. So they're not doing it on behalf of the people.
And that's what's making me very nervous too, is just, I'm not sure if we are more divided as a people right now more than ever, or it's just more apparent and more visible that we're divided more than ever.
A little of both.
Yeah, and that's just getting, and that's what makes me nervous in the future. But I'm going to have to cut us off right here. I did want to say thank you again so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, George.
I hope you enjoyed this evening's episode of the Rights and Wrongs podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Alan Yeek or his organization, Altraged, there will be a summary on both on the guest appearance page of the website. The website can be found at www.rightsandwrongspodcast.com. If you want to support us, you can find us on Patreon. at Rights and Wrongs Pod, and you can enter some tiers to get some cool benefits such as joining the Discord server or get early access to episodes like this. On the website, you can also support us by either directly donating through a PayPal or buying some cool merch such as a mug or a hat. If you agreed or disagreed with anything that you heard, make your opinions or fact if you have some research heard, either through our articles, which are written by people such as yourself, or contact us at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com, and you could be a guest. Or you could even come and interview me if you feel like it. Other than that, I hope you have a great night and stay safe.